Hello everyone, my name is Dennis Robinson, otherwise known as the world's most okayest DM. You can find me over on the show Botched, a D&D podcast. If you're not familiar, it's an improv comedy show draped in the loose skin of Dungeons & Dragons, with a little bit of drinking involved. This current season is set in the SCP universe, and if you're not familiar with that, well, think X-Files, but on steroids. You can check out the show on all your podcatchers or over at botchedpodcast.com. But what I really want to talk to you about is that I am a writer of indie graphic novels, specifically the Lycan Solomon's Odyssey series, which is a story of the world's first werewolf. It's a little bit of horror, a little mythology, a little adventure, and a dash of history. There are already two books out in the series, and the third one is live on Kickstarter right now until the end of March. This story, the best way I can describe it, is H.P. Lovecraft meets Gilgamesh. I have put in a ton of work on this Kickstarter, and we have rewards ranging from as simple as the book itself, all the way up to different apparel, glow-in-the-dark enamel pins, art prints, an adorable crochet werewolf, or, if you really want, you could have your likeness killed off in Lycan Solomon's Odyssey Chapter 4, and I promise it'll be an especially gruesome death. Please go and check out the Kickstarter over at www.lycanbook.com, that's LYCANbook.com, to check out the project. Thanks, take care, bye-bye.
You are listening to Podcasters of Horror, a podcast about exploring horror anthologies from film and TV, as part of the Super Network, with your hosts, Super Marcy.
And he just gave off, like, very creepy vibes, so you're always very unsure of this guy.
And the terrible Australian, Beat Germine.
Which, in that version, it's a Krusty the Clown doll that's harassing Homer.
This podcast may contain coarse language.
It just kept getting weirder and weirder, and what the f*** is up with this house?
Adult themes.
You know, she's only just a little girl, but he really is very mean to her.
And potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
Listener discretion is advised. For more information, please visit supermarcy.com or see the show notes. To show your support, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/thesupernetwork. Please enjoy the show.
G'day everyone, this is B. Jabide, aka The Terrible Aussie, and welcome back to episode 28 of Podcasts of the Horror, the podcast that started as a retrospective on Mick Garris's horror TV show, Masters of Horror, and has now expanded to other horror anthology film and TV shows. And with me, as always, is my very awesome co-host, the one, the only, Super Marcy. Hello, Marcy, how are you?
Hello, hello. Good to be back. This is one of my favorite podcasts, and I just love anthology that deals with some horror.
Indeed, indeed, indeed. So I'm very excited for this episode, Marcy, because we are going back into the zone, the Twilight Zone. However, though, we are actually going to be looking at a different incarnation of the series. So we're not looking at the 60s series for this one. We're actually going to be looking at the rebooted mid-80s series take on the show.
Yes. That doesn't mean we won't be still talking about the original series, but I think for this podcast series, we want to tackle all the iterations of the Twilight Zone shows. So it's pretty cool to, you know, start checking out this the series from the 80s.
Indeed, indeed, indeed. And I'm very excited for this one because we have three very interesting episodes to talk about for this one. But before we get to our discussion on them, Marcy, we have not one but two very special guests joining us today.
Yes, very excited. Two guests that we clearly love podcasting with.
Indeed, indeed, indeed. And our very first guest is someone who has been on other previous episodes of Podcasters of Horror. And he is back today to join us for this episode. And that, of course, is the killer horror critic himself, Matt Knopka. Hello, Matt, how, and welcome back to Podcasters of Horror.
Hey, thanks for having me back. Can't wait to talk about this tonight. I am very excited about discussing these particular episodes.
Hell yeah. I think, like us, Matt, you are most likely familiar with the original Twilight Zone from the 50s and 60s. But what about the 80s? Had you seen any other episodes from the series prior to this show?
You know, being honest with you, the 80s Twilight Zone was a little bit of a blind spot for me. So I feel like, some of these I've probably come across here and there, but I've never actually just sat down and really consumed this series. So a lot of this is very new to me.
Nice.
Well, it's definitely new to me as well because this is my first time watching any of the episodes from the 80s incarnation. But also joining us is someone who's actually making his debut appearance on Podcasts of Horror, even though he has been on other podcasts of ours over the years, and as well as the co-host, Marcy, of your spin-off show, The King's Own's Book Club, and as well as my co-host on my Beat vs. the Living Dead spin-off podcast, Beat and Steve versus Camp Crystal Lake. And that, of course, is Stephen T. Bolt. Hello, Steve. How are you? Welcome to the
Hello.
show.
Thank you, Bede. I am thrilled to be here talking about Twilight Zone. Thank you guys for having me on.
Now, I'm assuming, Steve, that you're a big fan of the original series of the show, but what is your feelings on the 80s incarnation?
I liked it. I liked it quite a bit. And I remember when it first aired, I remember the pilot episode was Shatterday with Bruce Willis, and it was based on a Harlan Ellison story. That's what really grabbed me. That Harlan was the creative consultant on the 80s Twilight Zone was very impressive to me. So, yeah, I was on board from day one.
Awesome. And also, let's not forget that very first episode was also directed by the late great Wes Craven as well, who actually directed quite a number of episodes of the 80s series.
Right.
Oh,
Yes, and I have actually seen bits and pieces of the 80s show, and actually, as we were as I was watching what we're going to be discussing, I'd realized I'd seen one of them before, and another one, it was a rewatch because I had seen it, and I think it was kind of the maybe the very late 90s or the very early 2000s when I started to check out just the odd segments from the show. Well, definitely well into the 2000s as well, because as you mentioned, there's a lot of notable directors that have worked on the show, and I have discussed in my time careers of horror directors, and a lot of these kinds of shows definitely have popped up for that. So I'm excited to get into these.
Wow. And by the 2000s, there was a third iteration of Twilight Zone floating around, and that was,
And I used to watch that as well. It was on TV late night.
And of course the Jordan Peele one, so
Yeah.
yeah, there's been like so many incarnations of the Twilight Zone over the years, and it's one of those shows that no matter what decade it comes out, it always still manages to tap into the zeitgeist as us as a society at the time. So we might as well get to it. And so for this episode of the show, we're going to be talking about three episodes from the 80s run of the Twilight Zone, which of course were the episodes Nightcrawlers, Grandma, and Button. So we might as well get straight into it. So we'll talk about the very first episode, which of course is from the first season and episode four, which of course is Nightcrawlers.
Nightcrawlers.
What was that? Nightcrawlers?
That's what it said in the lighter.
I was in Everybody in my unit got one.
Which was directed by the late great William Friedkin, written by Philip DeGroot, and based on a short story of the same name by Robert R. McCammon. This episode stars James Whitmore Jr., Scott Polin, Robert Swan, Bobby Bass, Sandy Barton, and Matt Levin. And the plot summary for this episode is a veteran of the Vietnam War shares his nightmares with patrons of an all-night diner. Simple, but there's a lot more to it than that. But
There certainly is.
indeed, indeed. And Marcy, your thoughts on the episode Nightcrawlers?
I love it when you pick on me first. I'm always just, even if I have notes, I'm so unprepared. But I'm just going to lead with this. This was the episode or segment I had not seen before. And I think it's well known. I really love what R William Friedkin has done as a filmmaker through his lifetime, RIP. So it was definitely like, yeah, I'm kind of intrigued to see what he could do with a 20-minute block. And holy shit, yeah, there's a lot going on. No, as I'm watching Nightcrawlers, I'm watching it being like, this could make like a really interesting, you could have this with like a triple feature. And I'm like, you would have like Rambo, Jacob's Ladder, and The Guest.
Mm.
So I'm not saying that something like The Guest was influenced by the story or this, but there's some little similarities that are in there. And I found this to be fantastic. It draws you in into this diner. But then when the strange man comes in and you find out like he's a Vietnam veteran, it completely, everything just changes and it becomes so dark. And it really sort of, trying to think of the right words, it's really about sort of that PTSD with, you know, something like the Vietnam War and what it, how it affects people. But of course it has certain other elements that bring it together, but it's a very compelling and really well done piece. I was really impressed, but I also got to say, I did not expect to see Mac's mom from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, Sandy Martin, just randomly show up in this. And I kind of marked out a little bit. But yeah, like everything about this just kind of comes together and it's like, holy shit, how is this 20 minutes of an anthology TV show? Holy fuck, this is wow.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And Matt, your thoughts on Nightcrawlers?
Well, I think I'll just start with, first of all, saying yes, agree to all that. This is a just almost like earth-shattering episode of television in my view, you know, because I'm just trying to picture going back to what was this 1985 and watching this for the first time, because I feel like that was kind of around when we started to talk about this a lot more in film, you know, and just like the sort of treatment of veterans and the way America in particular really treats them. And, you know, I'm just trying to imagine sitting back there in 85 and just how shocking it would have been then to see this, considering that, you know, even sitting here in 2024, I can watch this and just kind of be blown away by it. But I first of all, I'm a huge fan of Robert R. McCammon. I actually grew up reading him along with Stephen King and Dean Koontz. He wrote one of my favorite werewolf novels, which is The Wolf's Hour, which is amazing. You should go read it if you're listening to this. But the combination of him and Friedkin, I think, is really cool. And I think that Friedkin comes into this and, you know, he films it in a really memorable way. Like, I love the sequence where you have the veterans and kind of eyes over the shadow of his memory. You know what I'm talking about? Where they sort of just kind of take the cut out of his eyes and place it over the shadow him in this memory of himself. And I just thought that was really cool. You know, I miss seeing a lot of inventive creativity like that in film. I feel like I don't see it as much in major productions like this. But I guess maybe the best way to sum it up is watching it for this first time, it really kind of felt similar to me as the scene in American Werewolf in London where the Nazi monsters come in, you know, and just shoot up the family. Like, we'll get to it in a minute, I'm sure, but like once you get to the ending of this episode, it felt very similar to that, where just you're kind of along for like this fun mystery until all of a sudden it's just not really fun at all anymore, and it's just very almost upsetting, you know. So no, very, very powerful piece of anthology TV, you know, to do this in only 20 minutes.
Yeah, for real. Like, you kind of wanted to sit there for a full movie for this segment. That's how I was compelled, like, oh, wow.
Yeah, and I mean, they could easily do it or have done it, but no, very powerful episode.
And Steve, your thoughts on Nightcrawlers?
Well, I think, surprising to no one who's listened to you and me beat on versus Crystal Lake, I'm going to be the square peg here.
Oh,
I did. Yeah, this one didn't really hit me. It started off really strong. It actually started off like a classic Twilight Zone episode. I was thinking specifically of Will the Real Martian. Was it called Will the Real Martian Please Stand Up? Takes place in a diner, secluded. I don't know if you remember that episode, but there was a bridge that washed out. There was apparently a UFO. And, you know, it's one of those classic, sort of like the monsters are due on Maple Street, where there's paranoia, there's all of this, right? And by opening opening in the diner, it just evoked that for me. And I thought that was great. And we talk about the murder at the hotel that had happened, right? And all this is going on. We're setting up this paranoia business when Scott Paulin arrives. But almost right away, it lets the air out for me. Because you know he's the guy. Like, you just know he's the guy. The mystery and suspense of it is all gone at that point. And then it shifts gear because he starts creating, what is it, visions that these people are having? And now it's a different story, you know? I think what a couple of you have said is that this could have been feature length. This could have gone longer. And I think it deserved to go longer because none of the characters felt like characters to me. The family specifically was just there to be not
The family's background noise, basically.
Background noise, that's a great way to put it. They weren't even stakes characters. It wasn't even like, you know, I didn't care if they got shot up or anything, you know, going on. I did find it interesting, the storyline. And again, that sort of put me in mind, like you said, Matt, of certain things that were going on at this time, the mid 80s. But the story itself, and nothing against Friedkin here, this, I think, I go back to either Robert McCammon or Philip DeGuerre, just the writing on this one was not up to speed for me. I think you could have done this story in a short period of time with fewer characters. I don't think the family was necessary. I think, you know, you could have had one or two other people hanging out there and given them something to do. Right. Given them some flavor that would have added to the piece. But I don't know. This one, it was OK. But for me, it was a pretty it was just substandard for me.
I think that they're all very fair points. And just hearing you speak, I'm thinking, and it's like I think you could do a story like this as a play because it's in that one setting with just these few characters. I think that could be really interesting.
Yeah, for sure. I agree. Definitely.
And I do agree with the point that it does sort of rest on the laurels of like the impact of the ending, in the sense that you're right, the mystery of it is pretty much out the window the moment he walks into the diner. So that part is taken away. So it really rests on like, does it shock you or not? And you know, if not, then yeah, it's kind of a failure of an episode in that sense.
The big takeaway for me here, and I looked everybody up. I've never read Robert McCammon, which is insane because his books were everywhere when I was growing up. But I bypassed him, went right to Stephen King, and that was the end of it. So, but I know he did Boy's Life and Swan Song. They were huge. But I looked up Philip DeGuerre, who again, I grew up watching him. I was watching Bionic Woman that he wrote for Magnum PI and the like. He also did the 1978 Doctor Strange TV movie,
which we have a strange love for because that actor was in Night Killer.
There you go. I mean, yeah, I love that. I thought that was great, but I didn't sort of get a Friedkin vibe out of this. And I don't know if that's good or bad. Like, you know, if you want to, obviously wants to break out of what he's normally known for, then this, you know, TV would be a way to do that. But the takeaway for me, and Beat, I'm not sure you mentioned her in the beginning, I may have missed it, with the cast, was Exene Cervenka was in this. She played the waitress.
And
you know, I saw her name at the beginning and I'm like, oh, great. And it was about, I don't know, must have been 7 minutes in before I realized she was the waitress. I've never seen her with like her natural hair color and not all made up as a punk rocker. So this was amazing. This was great for me. This was fantastic to see her, in this. So if nothing else, I took that away from it.
I guess for me with this episode of Nightcrawlers, this was one of the episodes like when you and I, Marcy, were putting, you know, ideas out there from this incarnation of the show. This was the episode that I suggested, mainly because one of the reasons I did was I kept hearing a lot about this episode over the years. I'd seen a lot of different write-ups about it at different websites over the years, like from Bloody Disgusting and a few other places that I've always talked about this being one of the 80s version's best episodes, or it's one of the more intense ones. And I can definitely see what some of you have said in terms of if there's really kind of no mystery, you kind of figure it out pretty quickly what's going on. But I think what this episode does and what makes it great overall is it really dives into what was going on with Vietnam veterans at the time, because as Matt kind of suggested before, this is post-Vietnam, and we're starting to see many different types of media that explore the Vietnam War. You know, from up to this point, you had Apocalypse Now, The Deer Hunter, and then the year after this, you would have Platoon. That it was a very unpopular war that really psychologically scarred so many soldiers. And I like that this episode really kind of dives into that. And of course, you have the cop character played by James Whitmore Jr. when he kind of hears, like, you could definitely tell he's probing this character, because he kind of suspects that he may have had something to do with the motel fire and massacre that happened earlier that he was coming back from. So as he's questioning, but when he finds out that he's a veteran, he kind of talks about, like, oh, I wish I could have gone as well to serve my country and all that. And pretty much Scott Pollan's character of Price pretty much tells him, like, you don't understand. Don't even say things like that if you've never been there yourself. And it kind of shows on how this war really affected him, to the point where that, of course, that he and his comrades in the Nightcrawlers group got affected by this chemical. And there have been kind of talks about experimentation and Agent Orange and a few other things that have happened during the war, and that of course affected a few of them. And every time that they happen to dream, their visions or nightmares come to life. And he's a man who's haunted by what happened to his team and the violence and the bloodshed that they had caused. And, like, yes, when he's awake, he can create things out of air and manifest them in front of people, but it's only it's stronger when he's asleep. And I really like that this episode really kind of dives into the metaphor of that, and how all these things that brew up with a lot of Vietnam veterans somehow affect all of us on the outside. And I think having that, and I feel like, to me, this felt very much like a William Friedkin episode, because one of the great things about Friedkin as a director is how he can make anything incredibly intense. Like when you have the character of Price going into his monologue about what he experienced in Vietnam, that entire scene was incredibly intense. And Scott Pollan was, like, just going at that performance.
Yeah, he really goes overboard there.
Like, he really goes overboard, but you can get it. Like, you could get why this character is like this. And then, of course, you got Trooper Dennis, who, obviously, he's like one of those people, like I said before, like, he's never gone to war. He just thinks, he kind of sees it as almost like this patriotic kind of duty. Also this fact, like, romanticized version of war. And he wishes he was there, but the fact, but now he and also the fellow patrons are about to experience the actual horrors of it. Once Price gets knocked out and has his nightmare of the Nightcrawlers coming to the diner and shooting and blowing up everything, now these characters start to realize what this man has gone through. But also, out of all the characters, Trooper Dennis is the only one who gets killed. So in a way, it's kind of a poetic kind of justice for the ignorance of this character. And I feel like this is one where it's not necessarily about the story or about the mystery. It's more about a character study, but also the intensity of the situation that these characters in. And I agree with you, Marcy. This is an episode where that could easily work as a play. Like, you could expand it into a play. But I just found it such an enthralling and incredibly intense episode. And particularly that last sequence is, I could definitely see at the time why this episode did get a bit of controversy, because I think at the time it was like one of the most violent things ever put on television. And yeah, I think William Friedkin did a great job with this one.
Well, so this is the thing that I really liked about it, is that I definitely think that, yeah, you know, as a story, it maybe doesn't work quite as well. This is very much a short that's built on, I guess, the impact of the shock of it. And but as someone who lives in America, like, I can tell you that, you know, this was 85. Even now, there is a portion of the population that is war hungry and, like, has this idea that war is, like, I mean, I hate to use the word fun, but I feel like that's how a lot of people feel. You know, they feel like it's this enjoyable thing to do. They want to be a part of it and all this kind of stuff. And that was very much an attitude during this time as well when this was made. And it just, I love something like this that kind of takes a moment to tell those people like, hey, shut the fuck up for a moment and maybe think about what you're saying here and what war really means, you know, because I love the sheriff character and how he represents that in this sense of just, you know, he's almost like giddy, like a fanboy almost when he finds out that the character's been to war or Vietnam. And, you know, he's like excited to talk about it. And it just, it's like this disgusting segment of this country that just loves that shit. And the rest of us are sitting here like, what is wrong with you? You know? And so, so something like this, you know, I think it's important television in that sense because, you know, everybody watches The Twilight Zone. So for a moment, people that have that mindset, maybe they can watch something like this and suddenly think to themselves, maybe I'm wrong to consider, you know, having wanted to have participated in Vietnam. Like, maybe I should really think about the horror of it, because this is all a metaphor of like what he has experienced and the PTSD trauma that he's reliving, you know, that his nightmares coming to life become everybody's nightmares because he's this guy that hasn't been welcomed back into society and given the help that he needs. So I don't know. I think that's why it really upset me, is just because you still see this to this day and we throw these people into the gutters and just forget about them. And it just, I don't know. It's just very unfortunate. It hit me really hard. And that's, and that the stuff B was saying, that's why this one really sticks with me, I think.
That's why I wish we'd have cared more about the family.
Yeah.
You know, not just the guy who thinks war is fun and he gets killed. And that's pretty simplistic, I think. If we'd have cared more about the family and one of them had died, then you're really landing on the metaphor.
Yeah, because you're really displaying then the innocent people that are affected by this. Because the whole idea is bringing the war home, essentially. And I agree. I think it hits harder if innocents end up becoming a victim of it as opposed to like some war hungry sheriffs.
yeah, exactly.
And I think like with that whole ending sequence with, I guess, the PTSD manifesting in the diner and everything, like it's especially for like the mid 80s, seeing like a representation visually of PTSD, it's very frightening and it's very real. So I think that they really captured something that I don't think, I mean, really PTSD in media still doesn't get handled that great at times, but it felt like this is not like, it wasn't bullshitting around with it. It's like, no, this is how fucking intense it can be. And it makes you think like, why would you treat people like this, like such utter shit, and leave them homeless or whatever? Like, people need help.
Right. Well, so this is the one, this is the negative comment I do have on it, is that I don't know if this applies, but I saw someone the other day say something about like, you know why, like, there's always people saying you couldn't make this today, and it's like, you know why you couldn't make it today? Because it's not culturally relevant anymore. Mm. And even though this is culturally relevant, we're in a different time, and so maybe that's why I look at it this way. But and I'm not sure how this would have played in 1985, but the one issue I do have with it is that I think that if you were to make this today, there would be a lot more sympathy geared towards that character. And I'm not saying that there's none here, but the episode does sort of treat him a bit like someone to be afraid of, you know, because you have the end segment where they're wheeling off the cook, I think it is. And, you know, he's reciting to himself that there's four more of these guys. And he's like, four more vets who could do the same thing, you know? And to me, it's a little bit irresponsible because it almost kind of creates this fear of veterans when I think the point should be to garner sympathy, you know?
Yeah.
So that part rubbed me wrong a bit. I forgive it in the sense that it's 1985 and I realize that we're in a much different time now and look at these things differently. But I did think that the episode was a little bit irresponsible in that sense.
And going back to the Friedkin aspect, and Beige, you mentioned it's very intense, and it is. And according to production notes on the Wikipedia page, the cinematographer Bradford May said that Friedkin was the most challenging director he had worked with because he demanded like the utmost intensity from every shot. And when he wanted more intensity from Scott Paulin, you know, who played Price, like Friedkin put his face right up into Paulin's and shook him. And that kind of apparently scared everybody, or shocked everybody around. So I feel like there is a lot of intensity in it, and you can feel that from Friedkin, but that's like way too much, dude. Just back it up, back it up. It's okay. But you know, I think it's interesting that apparently Friedkin said he wanted to do this because he thought it was a great story and there was a good metaphor for how Vietnam continues to haunt people. And they shot it in like 5 days, and it was one of the most expensive segments from the entire series. And it boggles my mind how they pulled this off in like 5 days of shooting with a lot of pyrotechnics and stuff that happens towards the end. But I have to imagine
like 4 days of the shooting was all just the last couple minutes.
Yeah. It's really well done with, you know, on that visual level. And yeah, it is very intense, but yeah, I do agree with some of the faults that there are. Yeah. Overall, I really freaking liked it.
Mm. Oh, I was just going to say like, no, I do too. And you know, like I said, as for the faults, it was a different time, you know? So like, as far as my big issue with it, with being kind of irresponsible, like it just kind of have to look at it for the period it was made in. So like at the moment, I think it would have been great, but you know, looking back on it now, it feels a little bit different.
Hmm. I don't know. Like, I guess for me, I felt much sympathy for Price throughout the entire episode because it was basically out of his control. And to me, I could definitely see your point, Matt, in terms of like, especially for that last line from the cook. But I feel like at the end of the day, it's kind of really just more that society just doesn't know how to treat their veterans well, and people tend to get scared of them rather than actually try to help them. I mean, like, all Price wanted to do was just go back on the road, get out of there and not harm anyone. But of course, everyone in that diner, like, and also, you know, you got the deputy kind of just getting on his ass. So in a way, it's kind of similar to that First Blood type of mentality of you, when you push someone so far that they just snap. And of course, when he gets knocked out and then goes to sleep and starts dreaming, like, again, it's just like stuff that's beyond his control. So if anything, like, it's really kind of society that's more the villain in this episode, at least for me, rather than the veterans.
100%. No, 100%. And that's the thing, is like, I think that the emphasis is to create sympathy for him. It's just that if that's the case, you know, as a storyteller, that's just kind of the wrong way to wrap it up, is with that last line, because then you kind of take away all of that and say, you know, it becomes less like we need to help these people and more like, oh my god, there's four more of them out there, you know. It just, I don't know, maybe I'm reacting too heavily to it, but
that's all right though. But I guess that could be
you are, fuck you.
Indeed, fuck me. Anyways, I guess that could be a wrap on this discussion of night crawlers. Marcy, your final thoughts and rating for this episode?
I give it 4 out of 5 T-bone steaks that I can manifest with my mind out of 5. I just thought it was a really compelling and interesting and well done segment. I was very surprised. I encourage people to check it out. At the moment, you can find the episode on YouTube.
Definitely. And Matt, your final thoughts and rating for this episode?
Yeah, no, I think I'd give it a 4 as well, just in consideration of how impactful of an episode that would have been for the time it was made. So again, I just think it's the writing and story isn't always perfect. I do think that it does mostly what it means to do, which is shock you and point to a problem that we have that people aren't really treating the way they should be. So I do really like it.
And Steve, your final thoughts and rating for this episode?
Final thoughts. A noble effort, failed execution for me. Yeah, and I've got to give it I'll give it a 2.5, but that's a 3- and not a 2+. Is where I make the distinction. Okay. So it's like better, but then, oh, you lost points, rather than like, oh, you were kind of shit, but yeah, I'll give you another half. No, it just didn't quite get it for me, because Twilight Zone has always been about character, has always been character studies, and I think this one tried and missed the mark.
I'm giving this one 4 out of 5 as well. I think it does work, at least for me, as a character study, because it really gets us into the mindset of the Price character. And I think William Friedkin's direction is fantastic, and I think he really makes this such a intensely charged film from beginning to end. And as it sort of starts, it just slowly and slowly gets more intense until it gets to that final third where it just goes completely insane and violent. And I think the performances are all very strong. And yeah, to me, this was an episode that definitely lived up the hype for me. And yeah, so 4 out of 5 from me. Now we'll move right along to our second 80s Twilight Zone episode, which of course is the episode Grandma.
George, bring me my tea.
Which was directed by Bradford May from a teleplay by Harlan Ellison based on the short story of Stephen King. Wait a minute, this isn't a King's Own podcast episode. And this episode stars Barrett Oliver, Darlene Flugel, and I probably butchered your last name, so please forgive me, Frederick Long, and Piper Laurie as the voice of Grandma. And the plot summary for this episode is, young Georgie, no, not from It, is afraid of his ailing grandmother. His mother leaves him alone to take care of her. Now, we're going to switch things around a little bit. Steve, since you are the co-host of our spin-off King Zone podcast show, the King Zone's Book Club, tell us your thoughts on this episode, Grandma.
I love this episode. I love this episode because I love this short story. And I think it's such a tight adaptation. Like, it gets everything. Everything that needs to be in there is in there. It's really brave. I watched all three of these episodes with my wife, who'd never seen any of the 80s Twilight Zone episodes. And I got very excited to show her Grandma, because the first thing I said was, look, it's all done in voiceover, which is very brave for a show to do an entire episode in voiceover when voiceover is universally cried out against. Like, that's what we're taught in writing. It's like, don't ever use voiceover. It's the worst. Nobody likes it. And this whole episode is just voiceover. So I thought that was very cool. And really the only way it can be done. You can do a lot of the things that Georgie does in this episode with, you know, with a look. Like a veteran actor will look at this script and go, no, I'm not saying that. I'll do this with a look and blah, blah, blah. But a lot of Georgie's memories come up. He remembers hearing his mother and his aunts and uncle talk about Grandma and her, quote, spells, which I loved. And this sort of, that couldn't be done any other way than having Georgie remember it. What I kind of tripped over was, I don't want to bag out little Barrett Oliver, because he was great. But sometimes, I guess it was the direction, okay? Sometimes his voiceover didn't match the emotion on his face. Like, his voiceover, he would say one thing in his head, and then he would immediately contradict himself and sort of berate himself for having that thought, but it wasn't coming through on the actor, you know? And I that's all on Bradford May. That's fine. We're not going to, you know, blame a 10-year-old kid for that, you know, for that thing. I did love it. I think it's one of the coolest stories in the collection, in Skeleton Crew, which I absolutely devoured when I was 15. That was it for me. That was a great one. So I do. I'm a big fan of this one. Big, big fan of this one. It incorporates some Cthulhu mythos, which I'm all for, and also sort of grounds it within the King universe as well. This is, I'm not sure if it's mentioned specifically in the episode, but this is a Castle Rock story. They have Georgie's mom has a party line, which at the time you split your telephone line between yourself and another home. And Georgie is listening. He picks up the phone and he listens to Mrs. Dodd. And while, again, they don't go specifically into that in the episode, I know in the short story, that's Henrietta Dodd, That's Frank Dodd's mother, the serial killer from Dead Zone. So these little things, love it. Absolutely love it. Grandma is a fantastic episode, bar the sort of Muppety looking grandma that we get. Like, well, once grandma's revealed and she's, you know, she's a giant Muppet, it's a little weird. It's a little weird. But otherwise...
It's why they're smart to keep her in the darkness most of the
absolutely. Absolutely. Only shadow. I don't want to see too much, you know. They did have to show the eyes, her eyes, because of the tag at the end, the sting, I guess. But otherwise, I'm just, yeah, absolutely in love with this episode.
Nice. And Marcy, your thoughts on Grandma?
Well, this is the weirdest prequel to Hereditary I've ever seen. Damn. I did see this. As I put it on to like watch it, I'm like, holy fuck, I have seen this. Because I remember, and again, it was like maybe early 2000s or something. I was like, you know, Barrett Oliver was in The NeverEnding Story, plays Bastion. He's Daryl in, that's a great 80s sci-fi weird freaking movie. It's great. And I remember thinking, like, whatever happened? Like, did he do other things? And this was mentioned on it. I think I found it somewhere to watch. And yeah, as I was watching it, I'm like, holy shit, I remember this now. And I actually didn't realize it was Piper Laurie was grandma until the end. She was pretty upset about some dirty pillows on her bed. What can I say?
Those goddamn dirty pillows.
Damn dirty pillows. But yeah, like I do remember like all the whole thing was in voiceover, and it's like, oh yeah. But I it's a really weird and interesting little episode. And yeah, like Steve said, I think Barrett Oliver, and it's probably not down to him, but when he's doing the voiceover, it doesn't quite match what's on screen sometimes. But I think he did really well in just being able to do all this like voiceover, but also act very mute without really saying anything. Because you kind of bought that this kid is shit scared of creepy grandma. And by the end, like it's messed up. And again, I seriously couldn't help but think of Hereditary because of how it kind of goes. And grandma has Necronomicons and witchcraft books and all this stuff. But it's actually like, I'm very keen to read the story as you know, now that we've discussed this. Sitting there, I'm in Skeleton Crew. So pardon me, I'll have to read it. But yeah, I really liked this one. It's very different, but it's to the point. And yeah, grandma's fucking creepy. Go away, grandma.
One thing I said to Lou while we were watching it was that it didn't really feel like a Twilight Zone episode, though. It felt like Tales from the Dark Side.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, 100%.
Would have been an excellent Tales from the Dark Side episode. A little weird for Twilight Zone. A little more on the horror end of the spectrum for Twilight Zone. Mm. Doesn't usually go that route. But that was one thing that did stick out to me, that it would have been a fantastic Dark Side episode.
Mm. Yeah, I agree.
And Matt, your thoughts on Grandma?
Yeah, I mean, just on what Steve said, I 100% agree. It feels very much Tales from the Dark Side, you know, because Twilight Zone always kind of, to me, was about like the human condition and just kind of the way we work as a society and everything, and very sci-fi, obviously. So this definitely feels like a departure from that a bit, but I really like it. To me, this is a fun one. It's hagsploitation meets Lovecraft by way of Stephen King. I mean, you know, there's a lot there to like. And as for the voiceover, you know, like Steve was saying, it is kind of a general rule, I think, with writing that you often want to avoid voiceover as much as you can. There's very rare examples of how it works. And to me, I think the best voiceover is when it contradicts itself. When you're watching something like Goodfellas and Ray Liotta is like, all the kids brought us home groceries because they respected us. It's like, no, motherfucker, they were scared of you. Like, to me, that's when voiceover is the best. But I think it works here because you do have all of this sort of inner turmoil going on with the kid where he's kind of arguing with himself, you know, and to me that's very, it feels very real. It's not like he's just narrating. He really is just kind of in his head going through all of the different terrors and fears of what
can
happen.
And I think that's what like makes it kind of work, because it is like a kid's thought pattern and stuff, and it does contradict itself. And but again, it's very truthful to being like a 10, 11 year old kid.
Yeah,
totally. Right. And that's the thing, it feels very honest. Like it really does. Like, you know, it feels honest. Like, even though the acting isn't maybe A+, which again, I agree. I don't think that that's all on the actor. I do think the director needed to do a better job of making sure that what the kid was doing matched what the voiceover was calling for. So it doesn't all feel 100% genuine in that context. But I think in the writing and what is being said, I think that you really do feel and think like that as a kid. So it felt very genuine to me in that sense. I think that makes a lot of fun. I'm sorry, Matt.
What I was going to say there was in agreement with you as well. Like, I think none of this can be Barrett Oliver, as far as the voiceover goes, he's a great little actor. I mean, he didn't, make all these movies because he sucked, right? He was great. And like, listeners will be like, okay, but when you're having a thought process, you don't read it on your face. You could be thinking anything right now, and the general populace wouldn't know it. But on TV, you expect something different. You expect something a little different. Like, whether it's a sitcom, generally voiceover is not used in like dramas on TV or something like that. But, you'll find that Phoebe on Friends will be having a voiceover, and her actions, her face will go with what she's saying in her head.
Right, because it's a visual medium, so you want to see that represented.
That's exactly right. So while what Barrett Oliver was doing was probably very, very natural, it kind of feels odd in that respect. And maybe that's what Bradford May wanted from him, like more natural reactions than sort of making faces for the camera. I'll give him that, but it felt odd.
Yeah, very, very off-putting. But again, it's Lovecraft and this very weird story, so maybe it's kind of supposed to feel.
Maybe it helped, right?
I guess for me, for this episode, we are going to be covering another adaptation of this story in a future episode of the King's Own podcast, which is called Mercy. So I look, and that was one of the reasons I think, Marcy, you and I put this episode on the list as well, to kind of compare a previous adaptation of this story. And I gotta say, I really enjoyed this episode as well. It did take me a little bit to get into the episode, mainly because of all the narration. Not to say it was bad or anything like that. It just like it's so rapid fire, but it's appropriate given that it is from a kid's point of view. And of course, when a kid is thinking to themselves, of course, their mind is going to be racing and their line deliveries are going to be just so quick. And I do love the fact that even in the dialogue, it still feels very Stephen King-esque, especially from a kid's point of view. Like, just all those little quirks that we know Stephen King for is very much the dialogue, especially when Georgie finds the Necronomicon and he's trying to pronounce all the names from the book. And then when he finds Cthulhu, and it's like, Cargill, and it's like, even though he's not saying it correctly, it's like, there's a little bit of a Lovecraft cosmic horror going on here. And I like the fact that this is basically that type of story, this Lovecraft cosmic horror type of story, but a very small scale centered around a kid. And I think that's what really intrigued me the most about it. And also, you can definitely tell that this episode was directed by someone who's also a cinematographer, because Bradford May, as we talked about before, also shot Nightcrawlers, and he also did a lot of cinematography.
Monster Squad.
And this is his first directorial effort, and mainly because William Friedkin was meant to direct this episode and even cast and set up everything and ready to go, but he had to drop out at the very last minute due to some family problems. So Bradford May, who was the cinematographer on the episode, stepped in to direct because he wanted to direct at some point. I thought, might as well direct this. And you can definitely tell, like I said, it's full of atmosphere. The way he uses the camera in this episode is really unique, especially that first scene where it's essentially just Georgie just going around the kitchen and doing a few things, and it's done in one long continuous shot, which and also like even like him pulling the camera back and going down the hallway, like you can definitely tell he's just doing a lot of cool tricks with the camera in this episode.
Yeah,
and
sorry, go ahead.
No, you go, Matt.
Oh, I was just gonna say, yeah, that's interesting because, like we've discussed, you know, maybe the direction of the actors isn't necessarily spot on, but so you can kind of see the sort of rookie element there, you know, with this being an early directorial debut of his. But I do think as far as the camera work goes and building atmosphere through the lens of the camera, like it's very effective. Like I love the way that they kind of take this what would otherwise be a mundane house and kind of turn it into like this creepy gothic manner almost, with the way that the hallways are expanded to look like they go on forever and everything's dimly lit and we don't see grandma at all. You know, you can tell that as a cinematographer he really knows how to create that sort of atmospheric dread and kind of do a lot of suspense and mystery with not really showing us grandma and kind of keeping us hidden from that reveal, I guess, of like what's really going on here. So I love the way it's shot. That's probably my favorite part about it, to be honest.
Question for everyone. What was up with Georgie's shadow sort of disappearing and going down the hallway?
The only thing I can think of, especially where the episode goes in the end, is basically I think Grandma wants to take over Georgie's body. So I'm assuming that she is slowly taking him, including his shadow.
Right. I saw it as a bit of foreshadowing there, you know, but Georgie seems to see his shadow disappearing. So it wasn't just in his head. He actually saw that shadow. I wouldn't have gone anywhere near that fucking bedroom after that.
But that's why he keeps arguing in his head. He's like, oh, I'm going to get in trouble if grandma dies on my watch or something.
Fuck that. She stole my shadow. I'm out in the porch, snapped into a fetal position. I'm rocking back and forth. That's just too weird. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. I just wanted to get you guys' take on that. Cause that was the one bit where I'm like, I wish I could ask Harlan what that was about. You know, like, okay, I see what you've done there, but why have you done it?
Exactly.
I think it was the shadow foreshadowing.
Well, and that's
the foreshadowing nose, right? Shadow.
It's so on the nose for Harlan Ellison. I'm like, geez, Harlan. Okay, all right.
Very on the nose, really.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
He really wants to emphasize how stupid this fucking kid is.
I mean, there's that too, yes.
Well, at the
end, you're supposed to be like, man, that kid was a fucking moron.
Well, to be fair on the kid, it's really his mum should have left him alone, especially when they know that something's going up with grandma.
But do the parents know that grandma's a fucking Cthulhu monster?
Like... Absolutely. They know everything about this. This is one thing my wife and I talked about too. It's like when they're talking about her spells, that's...
They know.
Code, but like then you find the magic book and it's like, oh, you mean this? Like, no. They know what's going on. They know exactly going on. It's totally bad parenting to let him there. Right?
Maybe it's not bad parenting at all. Maybe these parents were like, yeah, this kid's really fucking stupid and we're done with it. You know? Like they left him there on purpose. They're like, grandma, take him over. We don't give a shit anymore.
I think it is an
odd
decision.
The kid will literally watch his own shadow walk away and still go towards it.
I think it is an odd decision for her, especially in the beginning when she shows the only compunction she has about leaving him is that he might be too young. As any normal parent would be to, you know, oh my God, can he handle the responsibility? But we're given no indication of what that responsibility like actually amounts to.
Right. Is he too young to go to the old one's hell?
it's very bizarre that comes down to King. I mean, that goes back to King. But it's a story. It's a story about intergenerational trauma. You know, of course, this little kid. I mean, look at the stress he's under. You know, he is under huge amounts of stress here, and he doesn't know whether. I don't know if you guys have ever read Arkham Asylum, but like, there's this great segment in there where they're taking Bruce Wayne through, giving him a tour, and Two-Face is sitting under a pool table, And the doctor is like, look, you know, we took away his coin and we gave him, you know, we gave him something else, that we gave him dice, and that allowed him 6 choices. And then we give him a deck of cards. Now he has 52 choices. And the dude literally can't decide whether to go to the toilet. So he just stays under the pool table and pisses himself. You know, that's the sort of stress that Georgie is under right here, right now. And it's excruciating to watch, because, you know, grandma would have been laying this shit on her daughter and sons, right? And here now, mom is doing it to Georgie, putting him in undue pressure as well.
Definitely. Well, I guess that could be a wrap on our discussion on grandma. Grandma.
Grandma.
But Steve, your final thoughts and rating for this episode?
I loved it in spite of its, you know, couple flaws. Would have loved to see the William Friedkin version now that I know that was a thing. But I really do. I really love it. I go 4 out of 5 on this one.
Nice. And Marcy, your final thoughts and rating for this episode?
I give it 4. I'm not staying home with weird creepy grandma out of 5. It's a really solid 20 minutes of like a segment. It just works really well. And again, the visual style really works, and it's very different because it's just told in this narration. So again, it's another one to certainly check out. And as we're recording, I haven't read the short story, but I intend to, definitely.
And Matt, your final thoughts and rating for this episode?
I think I give it about 3.5. You know, it just, there's that little bit of kind of awkwardness to it that doesn't quite work for me, but I think that overall it's a really fun story. I love the way that it's filmed. I think it looks great. And yeah, just, I just think it's a really enjoyable story. You know, again, Lovecraft, Hagsploitation, Stephen King. I mean, there's a lot to really enjoy there. And I think it touches back on, I mean, first of all, I do have to say this because I haven't said it yet. I do kind of love the sort of, I don't know if I want to say it's like a joke, but the sort of idea of, like, you know, the Lovecraftian lore is all about the old ones and we're dealing with grandma. So it just, I don't know. I kind of like that little joke there. I just think it's a really fun episode. I love the restraint of it. I think that's a thing that I really appreciate compared to what you would probably see now. You know, nowadays, grandma would be like running out of the room, full, you know, CG Lovecraft monster. Whatever. I like the patience of this episode.
Yeah, it would definitely have 300% more tentacles.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yes. Indeed. Indeed. I give this episode about 3.5 as well. I enjoyed it overall. Like, some of the narration did take me out of it a little bit in terms of how it's handled. But other than that, it's still pretty well done overall. And also, I like the atmosphere and the creepy vibe it had. And I also like the fact that it's just kind of a small-scale kind of Lovecraftian story, too. Mm. So, and also, Barrett Oliver, I think, did also a really good job with his performance in this one as well. So, yeah. So, overall, 3.5 from me. Now, we'll move right along to our third and final episode from the 80s Twilight Zone series, which, of course, is the episode Button Button.
When you push the button, 2 things will happen. First, someone whom you do not know will die.
Which was directed by Peter Matic, teleplay by Richard Matheson under the pseudonym of Logan Swanson, based on the short story by Richard Matheson. This episode stars Mayor Whittingham, Basil Hoffman, and Brad Davis. And the plot summary for this episode is: a mysterious stranger gives down-and-out couple Norma and Arthur Lewis a box with a button on it. He states that if they press the button, they will receive $200,000 and someone they don't know will die. Now, Matt, your thoughts on this episode, Button Button, which happens to also be based on the same short story that for the 2009 film The Box from Richard Kelly. So your thoughts on this one?
I was going to mention The Box with Cameron Diaz. I think that Button Button is basically a perfect Twilight Zone episode. To me, this is kind of a lot of what Twilight Zone is about, right? It's just kind of who we are and how we act as a society and all that kind of stuff. And it's so funny because it's such a simple idea, yet it's so effective. You know, it's such a simple story. It's just this woman basically arguing with her husband of like, am I going to push the button or am I not going to push the button? But there's something really kind of fascinating about it, because I think it kind of gets to the core of like who we are as human beings. Where are you the kind of person who is going to say what she says and consider something like, oh, you know, people die every day, like what does it matter if it's one more because I push the button? Or are you going to be the person who says, I don't want to be the cause of it for money? And it just, I don't know, it's just a really, I think it's a fascinating kind of conversation about us as human beings and like where we kind of draw the line with our empathy and all that. I think it's a perfect Twilight Zone episode. I really like it. It ends on one hell of a note that I think just really makes you just feel satisfied, I think, at the end of it, all things considered. So no, I really dig this one.
And Marcy, your thoughts on Button Button?
Yeah, this I had seen this before. It had been quite some time because I totally forgot that Mayor Winningham was in it. So it's a nice surprise when I went back and rewatched. I'm like, oh yeah, awesome. And yeah, I really like the episode. Like Matt said, it feels like a Twilight Zone episode, and this is sort of what you kind of would think you'd get from a Twilight Zone episode. And it is such a fascinating sort of story that you can understand that the short story was later turned into the film The Box, which is pretty okay. But yeah, obviously it's condensed in this version, but it does give this kind of moral, you know, the whole moral thing is kind of the moral of the story. It's like, well, yeah, you're living in poverty and someone gives you an offer. Well, here's 200 grand, but you only get it if you press this button. And by pressing this button means someone's going to die. You're almost like a random hitman or something. And like you see through the whole segment that Arthur and Norma, the two characters, debate whether it's real, what they should do. And ultimately, you know, that button is going to get pressed. And the end implication is that, well, it goes to another person that you don't know, but if they press the button, you could be the one that's killed because you don't know them. And that was the rules. And I haven't actually read the story, and again, I'm very intrigued too, but I understand that the story's ending is different to what they did in the Twilight Zone. And the writer Richard Matheson actually went under a pseudonym for the teleplay because he didn't like the ending they picked. So I find that interesting, and I'm very curious to read it and see what this other ending is and what makes it different and all that. But it is a very fascinating kind of moral dilemma. Like, would you press a button for a lot of money, but it means someone gets killed? And you know what, I would love money, but at the expense of someone else's life, no thank you.
Well, I think that's what's so fascinating about it, right? Is it's like, what would you choose? It's one of those things that really makes you think of like, man, what would I do?
I don't think I could live with myself knowing my actions caused somebody to die. So
yeah, I don't
fuck
think
your
so
box, either. Fuck your money, get the fuck out of here. Pretty much.
It does, Steve. Exactly. Steve, your thoughts on Button Button?
Yeah, I like this one quite a bit. I really do. I don't have a lot to say about it because it's almost a perfect thing. It's almost just everything is there. Like all the gears work. You know, there's nothing that's wrong in this episode. It's sort of comical. The characters are cranked up to 11. They both play it way over the top. Mayor Winningham, she is so greedy and narcissistic in this. It's hard to believe that, you know, Brad Davis's Arthur would ever have paid her any attention. And he's so wonderful in this. I've never seen Brad Davis in sort of a humorous role like this. You know, I just think, you know, Midnight Express all the time. That's it for Brad Davis. But then, you know, there's this, and he's sort of, he's put upon. He's got this stutter, that he plays up when he speaks to her. I love their characters. I love the fact that he is working all day on their car and then goes out at night to work while she sits at home and does nothing but berates him. Right. And then
and smokes a lot of cigarettes and stares at the box.
Of course, she's going to take the easy way out. She's going to press the button. But then this guy who's working like 18 hours a day, he's like, no, well, of course you don't press the button, you know, and it just, yeah, again, it says about, it says things about who we are as people, you know, would she, and 200,000, that's not even a lot. Like, right. That, you know what
well,
I mean? Like,
in today's money, back then it was, I'm sure.
No.
I mean, it's
no,
a nice man, amount of maybe. Money, but it's not going to like provide not, for you the rest of your life, you know?
Yeah, it's just enough to get you out, right? If it were $2 million, now you've got a conundrum. Right?
But now we're talking.
Right? Then, yeah, okay. Then I'm going to have a bit of an ethical quandary. But $200,000, you just go, oh, okay, that's not even, like, in today's money, yeah, I can't even buy a house with that.
In today's money, that's like one house payment.
You know?
I mean, try buying a house with that in fucking Los Angeles. Jesus Christ.
Right? This is what I'm saying. So, but even then, that's even a down in 86, payment. Even in 86, it's like, okay, that's a nice amount of money, but as you say, Matt, you're not going to retire on that.
Right.
You know? So where is it going to get you? So I found that really interesting as well.
I think that's like a kind of a fun part of the commentary, right? Is like her character is just the most miserable, lazy fucking person you can possibly imagine. And I love that they really play up the irony with her too, because I love that the customer just must have been having a day with the outfits they were picking out for her, because, you know, one shirt she's wearing is like a really happy sun, you know, and it's just the complete opposite of who she is as a person.
That's so great. That's so good.
These cartoony shirts that she's wearing. But it really, you know, it speaks to like a very particular kind of person that doesn't want to earn anything, wants to blame and judge every single other person, but doesn't want to work a day in their life. Because like you're mentioning, you know, he's going out and working and doing all this stuff, and she just literally just sits at home smoking cigarettes, and we don't really see her do anything else.
Yeah.
she doesn't even bother to get fucking dressed for the day, you know? I mean, she's just wearing a t-shirt and nothing else. Like,
right.
So it's basically the worst person you can possibly imagine who just wants money without earning it. And I think that that's such a common person that it's really fun to kind of watch them be put in this dilemma and then get the much deserved comeuppance that they do
yeah.
at the end. So
I liked Basil Hoffman is in this as Stewart, but I kept picturing William Finley. I don't know why. I think it would have elevated the role to get, Phantom of the Paradise in there. That would have been great for me, because I don't know, they both got the bug eye thing going, you know, and I just couldn't not see William Finley in there for me. But yeah, I thought this was a good one, man. I really enjoyed this one. And it is quite different from, Marcy, as you mentioned, it's quite different from the original story, but I prefer this ending.
Yeah, I like this ending a lot.
Yeah.
Well, another reason why I was very much interested in this episode is because, well, what I'd sort of mentioned before is that the same short story was also used for the 2009 film, The Box. So I was kind of curious to see, again, like Grandma, another earlier adaptation of this story. And of course, I knew what the plot was going to be. So I was kind of curious to see how they were going to do it in a much more shorter time frame in this one. And I got to say, I really enjoyed this episode a lot as well. I think both Mayor Whittingham and Brad Davis are great in this episode, and particularly seeing Mayor Whittingham being a bit more loose with her performance and having a lot more broader of a character to play with, and also providing a lot of humor. Like, there's actually a lot of good comedy in this.
She had a lot of fun just playing this awful, trashy type of character.
Oh, yeah, I mean, exactly. They're both so over the top. It's great.
Oh, yeah. Like, and again, like you say, Steve, it was interesting to kind of see Brad Davis in a different role, because, again, I really kind of only associate him with Midnight Express and how dramatic of a role that is. So kind of see him getting to be loose and be a bit more comical and broad with his performance was very much a treat for me. And I just really enjoyed their performances and their rapport with each other, but also the conundrum as well. I have to admit, before I found out what the original ending of the short story was, I honestly thought that was where this episode was going to go, that once she presses the button, it was her husband was going to die. And then, of course, it would find out, oh, she basically, her husband was a stranger to her. That's where I honestly thought the story was going to go.
Good thing too,
yeah, which I think is a good idea. And I honestly thought that's where it was going to go, and then it didn't. And then hearing what the original ending was, I was like, wow, I kind of figured out what the original story was. But then at the same time, when it kind of didn't go in that direction, I'm thinking like, that can't just be it, right? Like they press the button, someone they don't know dies, and they get the money. And I'm thinking, okay, that's it. I need something a little bit more with this episode. And then when that final line comes in from Basil Hoffman saying like, oh, the box is going to go to someone else, and don't worry, it's going to be someone you don't know. And I like that the episode kind of hangs on this kind of note where basically like now Mayor Whittingham's character is now going to be basically living her life, well, the rest of her life in fear. Because whoever gets that box, like if they press it, she could be that random stranger who dies.
She pretty much has to live the rest of her life like she just watched the Ring videotape.
Exactly.
I mean, speaking of buttons, right? It's like the perfect button on the episode. I think that it implies that she doesn't really have much of a life to live from this point, you know? Like it basically... It kind of gives the sense that every person this button is passed onto, if the next person decides I'm going to push it, the previous person probably is the one that, you know, gets off. So I think that it's more of a way to say of like, you've sacrificed someone else for this money that in the end isn't even worth it at all. Like your selfishness ends up not even getting you anything in the end because you're barely going to live long enough to even enjoy that money, if at all. So, I love the ending. I love that it ends that way. I think I think the original and what you were saying is a good idea, but I think that this hits better for, you know, an anthology show where generally you want to see people kind of get what's coming to them. And I feel like that with at least the character that is as portrayed, you know, her husband dying and being someone that she didn't know wouldn't really have had the same impact because you sort of look at her as someone who doesn't really give a fuck about her husband.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, it doesn't have the same punch at all.
Exactly, yeah.
But I think that's kind of one of the interesting things is like hearing all these kind of both the ending for this episode and also the original short story ending. It's one of those rare cases where either ending just works for this type of story. Yeah.
I think the implication is a lot more sinister for the fact that if her husband dies, is she really going to give a fuck? No.
Well, and I think ultimately it kind of ends with the idea that, which I'll admit is kind of a phrase I think is bullshit, but the whole idea of like money doesn't buy happiness, which I agree it doesn't necessarily, but it sure does make things easier.
It makes things easier, that's for sure.
But I think either ending, you know, kind of ultimately falls on that of like, is any amount of money really worth being a terrible person in the end? So,
I mean, billionaires haven't worked that out.
Well, I was going to say, it depends on who you ask, isn't it?
Jeez. Well, yeah, no, for sure.
Exactly. Exactly.
Oh, billionaires. Don't know how to do anything at all except fuck shit up.
Indeed, indeed, indeed. And like, yeah, I think it's just a really solid episode overall. Like, I have to admit, like, outside of the moral implications of what, and it is like you say about a perfect Twilight Zone episode because it does have that sort of character study. We're seeing these characters in a conundrum, and then of course it has the big ending. And yeah, I just think it's just a really well handled one. And being that even though Richard Matheson took his name off this episode and replaced it with a pseudonym, I still reckon it's still a pretty well-written episode. And then particularly with that interplay between Mayor Whittingham and Brad Davis's characters, because I think they're both really good in this episode. And like I say, like I will admit, I did laugh quite a few times, especially from Mayor Whittingham.
Yep.
I think that's okay. I think you're supposed to laugh.
it's got like a dark humor to it that really works.
No. And we kind of seen that before with from Peter Matic, the director, because he seems to do that with a lot of projects, like even bringing some dark humor to the story.
It's so funny to me, though, to think that the guy who made The Changeling did this kind of over the top.
Yeah. And that's one of the most like atmospheric and just genuinely like unsettling films. And then you look at this, and it's like, oh, okay.
Yeah, it felt very different tonally.
Oh, you're side safe.
No, I just said, and now for something completely different.
But I guess that could be a wrap on this discussion of Button. And Matt, your final thoughts and rating for this episode?
I mean, I don't really know if I have anything else to add. I think it's a really well-done episode. I think it kind of hits the Twilight Zone vibe perfectly. So I would maybe give it a 4.5 instead of 5, just because there are moments where like the performances are maybe a little bit too much for me, but considering the vibe of the story itself. But I do think it's fucking great. I love this episode.
And Marcy, your final thoughts and rating for the episode?
Again, I'm like 4 across the board with all of these because I actually really enjoyed all of them. But yeah, 4 out of 5. I'm not pushing the button. You take your fucking money and fuck off.
Not for $200,000. We'll talk.
Not for that. Like if it's $200 billion, maybe.
Right.
But yeah, like again, it's just you should watch it. It's a really good episode. And again, like I kind of just want to read the story and just see how it flows with that original ending as well. But it's kind of made me curious to revisit The Box, which I don't think I've seen for like 14 years. And I was in the middle of it. I thought it's got good and bad things. There's something there, but I don't think it quite achieved it. But yeah, like I said, it's made me curious.
It's very much okay.
Yeah, it's made me curious, but I don't know how curious. Okay, yeah. 4 out of 5, yes.
And Steve, your final thoughts and ready for this episode?
Nothing to add. I'd just be echoing you guys. I mean, really, it is a great episode. It's a classic episode. It feels like it fits right in there. And it's fun. You know, people forget Twilight Zone can be fun. You know, so I give this one 4, absolutely 4 out of 5 for this one.
I'm going to give this episode for me about a 3.5 out of 5. I think it's a pretty solid episode all round. And I think the ending definitely kind of sealed it for me. Although I have a question though, and I forgot to bring this up before. Now, even though we know the two different endings that this story has, now, would this story be as effective if they slightly tweaked it in like you press the button, you get the money, but would it be as effective if one of the things was that somebody you know dies? Would that be just as effective?
I think because if they say someone you know dies, like it could be someone I know that I fucking hate and wish were dead, or is it going to be someone I love very dearly? And like, I think it can open up different moralities, but either way, not pushing the button.
I think nowhere near as effective because, you know, if it's someone you don't know, it releases you of like 99% of the guilt. If you know somebody like Marcy, you know, it could be someone you love or someone you hate. You don't know. They're not clear about that, you know, and I think it would change it drastically. I think most people would never press the button if it was someone they knew.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah, no, I completely agree. It's more of a moral conundrum if it's someone you don't know, you know, because then it does become the question of like, well, I don't know them. So how much does it really matter to me, you know?
But you could also be like, you know, there's 1/20th of a chance if I push this, it's going to kill the person I hate the most. Like,
yeah,
it's
just a very different moral question. So I think that I'm not saying it couldn't be effective, but it would be a very different, I think, ultimate effect.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of agree as well. But that being said, though, I think some people would consider it.
He's like, I'm pushing that button if they say it's someone I know. Fuck.
I mean, it comes down to the money. Because, see, this is why the film version the box actually changed the money to $1 million.
It's still $1 million in 1970, mid-1970s.
$1 million.
$1 million. It's probably worth a bit more in like the mid-70s.
See, like $1 million, I'd be like, probably not. But if somebody offered me $1 billion, I'm like, okay, let's write down the pros and cons of this.
I mean, look, if it's $1 billion, I'm probably pushing the button. I mean,
if it's like $1 billion,
is nothing compared to the people if it was help $1 billion.
All right, how about this? It's $1 billion that you get, and if you push the button, a billionaire in the world will die. Everyone's pushing that fucking button.
Yeah, I'm not even hesitating, Marcy. Fuck them.
in some ways, you will push that button. There's some scenarios.
Hang on, wait a minute, Marcy. Was that you get $1 billion and a billionaire dies?
Yes.
No, I would never press that button because that makes me next in line.
Exactly.
Oh,
see?
That's a problem.
Ooh,
yep. See, I thought of that too. But a lot of people wouldn't.
Steve is thinking about
button.
It. Steve's on top of this.
But I guess that could be a wrap on this episode, yes, of Podcasters of Horror. And I think we've left it on an interesting note for our listeners to ponder upon and think about for this episode. And thank you, Marcy, for being an awesome co-host, as per usual. And thank you, Matt and Steve, for coming on this episode and talking about these free 80s Twilight Zone episodes with us.
Thank you. This was fun.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Yeah, like you say, Marcy, we're definitely going to go back to the original version very soon and discover more episodes from there. But I would also like to come back to the 80s version at some point because, you know, like we talked about before, there's so many other episodes I've been reading about that sound interesting. And also the fact that Wes Craven directed quite a number of episodes as well. Maybe we might have to do an episode where it's like the all Wes Craven episodes of
There's
Twilight Zone.
So many possibilities. And I do want to, you know, like I said, I want to dive into the 2000 show with some episodes or segments at some point. And of course, the more recent iteration.
Exactly. Exactly. But Marcy, where can people find us on the internet this week?
If you want to find us on the internet, we're at supermarcy.com. Podcasters of Horror should be on all your major podcast streaming platforms. If you don't already follow us, please do so. And any follows, ratings, comments, all of that really helps. And, you know, any feedback you have that, you know, you can give us some of that as well. And you can find all the social links for the Super Network at the Super Network's link tree, which is linktr.ee/thesupernetwork. Me personally, I'm Super Marcy everywhere except Letterboxd, where it's Super_Marcy. And of course, if you look up Super Marcy, you'll probably find After Dark with Super Marcy, an adults only podcast, and also check that out. Thank you.
Awesome. And Matt, where can people find you on the internet this week?
Oh, God. Well, first of all, where you can find me, not worth finding. I mean, you know, I'm not worth stalking. But if you want to look for me, you can find me on Twitter at Killer Critics. My website, killerhorrorcritic.com, where I do reviews. You can find a bunch of pieces I do for Dread Central. Just look at my name, Matt Konopka. I also do a column at Manor Vellum and Daily Grindhouse. And and I don't know. You can probably look up Killer Horror Critic on Instagram. Maybe I'm there. So.
And Steve,
too much stuff to remember these days.
Indeed, indeed. And Steve, where can people find you on the internet this week?
Well, you can find me through either you or Super Marcy, actually, with Bede and Steve versus Camp Crystal Lake. Follow the Bede versus the Living Dead links there. And Super Marcy, we have the King Zones Book Club podcast, where we discuss short stories of Stephen King, which is a spinoff of your very own King Zone podcast. Linked through that. Also, if you're interested, check out my column over at forcesofgeek.com called Creep Shows and Fright Nights, where I look back at 80s horror films and basically just see whether they hold up today.
Hell yeah.
Nice. And if people were to find me personally, you can find me on Twitter, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd under B Javine as one word. You can find all my work and all the other podcasts that I co-host with Super Marcy over at supermarcy.com, and as well on all podcast streamers everywhere via the Super Network. And also you can listen to my solo show, Bede vs. the Living Dead, and as well as the spin-off podcast Beaded Steve versus Camp Crystal Lake, which I, of course, co-host with Steve on all podcast streamers everywhere via the Beat versus the Living Dead podcast feed. And also follow the both shows on social media on Twitter and Blue Sky under Beat vs TLD, and as well as a Facebook under Beat versus the Living Dead. So, yep, that wraps this episode of Podcasters of Horror. We hope you enjoyed this episode, everyone, and we'll see you all next time in the Twilight Zone. See you, everybody. Bye.
Bye.